Cheers, Daniel.
Oh. Cheers.
This is relaxing, isn't it?
That was supposed to be a mise-en-scene. We were supposed to sound very relaxed, but I almost spilled my beer on your laptop.
That wouldn't have been relaxing, would it? But we, even when we're trying to be relaxed at the moment, we come close to disaster.
When it comes to method acting, I'm not sure that relaxed, debonair, nonchalant are really quite up your street, are they?
No, no. I've got sort of a Charlie Brown forehead, haven't I, after the last couple of days. But it's been stressful. The furrows on my brow are deepening because we missed it, much publicised missed dinner a couple of nights ago, nearly missed dinner last night. The whole of the Giro d'Italia had to come across on the boat from Sicily to the mainland. And we weren't the only ones getting a little bit fraught, a little bit frayed at the prospect of a late night.
Stressful and frugal on the food front, hasn't it?
It has indeed. But, let's hear a little bit about how the peloton got across the Strait of Messina.
Kicking off with
the Irish champion Ryan Mullen of Trek Segafredo.
Oh, it's like a necessary evil, I think. I mean, you have to get off Sicily somehow, but would have been, I don't know, feel like it could have been maybe planned a tiny bit better in the sense that we didn't have to do a 4-hour drive after such a late. We didn't get to the hotel till 10 o'clock, so I think everyone had to skip massage yesterday and just go straight to dinner, but I don't know, I mean. We're in the car just because the car was quicker to the ferry. The buses ended up having to get the next ferry after we did, so they were like another hour and a half after we got in. So, no, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, I think the whole race had like a fast track through the public, and the public made their views well known about it as well. Like, okay, I've never heard so many car horns.
Lance and Dom, decent rep. Yeah, we were unlucky, I guess, with that boat who broke down, you know, so. Yeah, I also I was in pain in the bus, so I was cooling my knee because I crashed on the knees yesterday. So it was a long transfer, but at the end I just accepted and went to the shower part and lay down and watched some Netflix, you know. So I think we 10:30 we arrived in the hotel, something like that. And then I also still had a chiropractic treatment because of the knee. So at the end I got like 11:30, half an hour treatment still till noon of midnight, and then I tried to sleep as quick as possible. So yesterday no massage. I was the only lucky one with the chiropractic treatment because I crashed. So it is what it is, and it's also a grand scheme of a grand tour, and we have to deal with it. Yeah, but to be honest, I think like last year we finished in Messina. And then the next morning we took the boat, so we had like an easy night in Messina, you know, in the hotel. And then the next morning there was a well-arranged transfer. And now with the transfer from Israel towards Sicilia and then from Sicilia to here, I think I never experienced it like this in a Grand Tour. So it's a lot. Yeah, it's a little bit too much, I think.
I'm Ben King and I ride for Team Dimension Data for Quebeca.
Yeah, yesterday the stress stayed on after the race. We made a plan to park the bus down at the bottom of the mountain so we could be the first one there. As we were approaching the ferry, other teams were all passing us and cutting us off, and we ended up getting flicked for the first ferry and had to take the second one. So we waited quite a while to get on the ferry, then pulled on. It was a late night and a long day, especially with the finish up Etna. But I've heard stories about Giro transfer, so this is my first Giro. I might have been a little bit disappointed without one experience like that, but so far we've had two, including the flight from Israel to Catania. So it's been, it's lived up to its reputation, the Giro so far.
Ducati EF, dropback cannonball, powered by something.
Well remembered.
Yeah, we were pretty organised. We wrapped up and rode down the descent on our bikes and met the bus at the bottom of the descent, and then we went straight to the ferry port and we got on the first boat, well, the first available boat. We were back at the hotel maybe 9:30, quick massage, then a little bite to eat and then bed.
Adam Hansen, Lotto Soudal. Yeah, well, you know, some guys were not so happy with it, and I always said to them, do they have anything important to do tonight? And the truth is we've got nothing else to do except to go to the hotel and eat. The Giro is known for long transfers. This is the longest one so far, and to be fair, I think in 2008 and 2009 we had 3 or 4 days where we get to the hotel like 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. So what, last night was 20 past 10 or something. You know, it's not so bad, it's not the end of the world. I think what some guys were complaining about more is that there were certain riders that went to the hotels in a different form, and maybe this is more unfair. But you know, apart from that, if everyone's treated the same, then it's all equal.
Are you referring to some riders going in a helicopter?
Was it a helicopter? Oh, I thought it was a private jet, but you know, same thing.
Okay, Max Chandry's board director of the BMC Racing Team. Mm.
It was a long one, but you know, that's when you go from island to inland. I'd say the coming down Etna was really good. They did a massive great job, RCS. Then the boats, Caronte, I was just speaking, actually I saw Vini and Giannelli or the organization, and we're just waiting, and I said Caronte has 4 boats and they had a problem with 1 boat, so that kind of slowed things down. I don't know if it's an Italian thing of just saying a small excuse or whatever, but that's what they said. So I heard some teams did a helicopter transfer. We didn't.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Praia Mare.
In case you're listening to the Cycling Podcast for the first time, my name's Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Good evening. Buonasera.
Buonasera, Daniel. It didn't please everyone, the trip across on the boat last night, but not everyone took the boat, did they?
No, they didn't. A couple of teams, or a couple of contingents, factions from within teams, were in helicopters, weren't they?
They did, and one of those teams was Team Sky. Some footage emerged of Dave Brailsford getting onto the
Airwolf style footage.
Yeah, it was a bit, wasn't it, if you remember Airwolf. But the news we discovered late last night was that Chris Froome had not been on that helicopter. It had been intended that he would travel on the helicopter across from Sicily, but I gather from asking around this morning, well, it's now out in the public domain that he was delayed by the anti-doping control giving a sample. I gather from a reasonable source that Froome had a call of nature with about 40 kilometres to go in the stage, and then when he got to anti-doping, he thought, he gambled that he could fill the sample pot up to the line.
This is lurching into territory that
This is forensic detail, Daniel, that the listeners need to hear. Anyway, he couldn't reach the line with his sample. He only got about halfway, and then he had to wait. He had to drink loads of fluid before he could go again and reach the required amount. By which time, the helicopter really had to go. He apparently missed the helicopter by about 3 minutes. They just couldn't wait any longer for him because it was getting dark.
But we also knew that he was late because we saw him.
We did. Well, we were in Bagnara Calabria last night looking in desperate hope for somewhere to eat and get a pizza, which we managed to do. And
in
Chris Froome...
Pizzeria Dalí, thanks to the Pizzeria Dalí in... Bagnara Calabria, because they saved us, didn't they? They saved you. They saved me, really, by proxy.
They did. They broke my unintended fast. Came to our rescue. But we saw Chris Froome at just about 11 o'clock arriving at the hotel. Not ideal for him, that, I guess, when the helicopter had been laid on. Now, there's been a little bit of discussion about some teams taking helicopters across while everyone else had to go on the boat. Sky weren't the only ones, and are we able to clear up the rules on this? Have Sky kind of been a bit cute here?
Well, Lionel, Luca Guercilena, the manager of Trek Segafredo, explained to me that there is a rule, and I think that even in the International Olympic Committee's rules, there is a fairly vague, woolly phrase about all competitors in competitions having the same travel arrangements while under the auspices of that competition. And that kind of, well, is adopted by the UCI as well. However, individual races are at liberty to have their own rules. And the Tour de France has quite a specific rule about every rider having the same or comparable or very similar travel arrangements, but the Giro d'Italia does not have such rigorous rules.
Well, and we know, don't we, at the Tour de France, sometimes they lay on a helicopter to get off a mountain for, say, the top six on GC or however many people are still in real contention. I gather that in this case, the helicopters that Sky and Team UAE Emirates used were Giro organisation helicopters, which had to come across anyway, and they were effectively hired by those teams. They paid a fee, and that option obviously was open to any teams that wanted to pay that money. And I guess,
or could pay that money.
Or could pay that money, indeed. We don't know. No one would tell me how much it cost.
What do you reckon, ballpark?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to know whether it was on a meter.
Are you in the habit of taking helicopter rides?
No.
20 is not very far, was it? I mean, well, Sky, as the crow flies, Sky's hotel from the port of Messina, probably 60, 70 kilometres.
I would have thought so, yes, but they save themselves a lot of time because of the queues to get on the boat and so on. That was a little bit of sort of controversy that we've cleared up this morning. But like I say, Team Sky weren't the only team. UAE, Team Emirates also had their riders in a helicopter. There was actually some footage on Twitter of Diego Ulisi looking pretty uncomfortable with his helicopter trip. And I think, my anxiety over flying is, it's past now, but I'm still not keen on the thought of travelling in a helicopter. But anyway.
I once took one on the Artsy Race of Norway, and I was pleasantly surprised at how, well, comfortable it was, and I wasn't nervous at all.
Interesting. Well, this is not the helicopter podcast. It's a cycling podcast here at the Giro d'Italia. We're in Praia a Mare outside a bar here. The sky has gone a little bit grey.
Well, the weather's taking a turn. I've looked at the forecast for the next week and it's not very good. The bad weather is kind of going to follow us up the peninsula.
Well, let's recap stage 7 from Pizzo to Praia a Mare. It was a short one, 169 kilometres, pretty much on the one road that wasn't quite on the coast. It was just a little bit inland. There's a railway line in between the road and the coast, so we didn't have any great views particularly. Didn't really go through many towns. A pretty straightforward, uneventful-looking stage. Three riders went on the attack. Mikel Irizar of Trek, Maxime Belkov of Katusha, who's been in several breaks, and Davide Ballerini of Androni Seidemek. Androni Seidemek, Gianni Savio's team, have had a rider in every single break on this Giro so far. Impressive. Anyway, they didn't really get much advantage. They certainly didn't get let off the leash. With 60k to go, it was 2 minutes gap. With about 30k to go, it's still 2 minutes. So it was inevitable that this was going to get reeled in. Ballerini was the last man standing, but he was swept up. We're inside the final 15 kilometres. Alex Dowsett and Diego Ulisi were among the riders who tried something, but it was going to come down to a sprint. We all knew that. I was very confident that Elia Viviani would get his third stage win of the Giro, but he didn't. Sascha Modolo of Team EF Education First opened up the sprint perhaps a bit early. Viviani came past and was looking really good, but Sam Bennett, the Irish rider with Bora Hansgrohe, he had the speed and, more importantly, the staying power to stay in front once he had got ahead of Viviani. And that is the first Grand Tour stage win for Sam Bennett. He's been so close, hasn't he? Seconds and thirds. He was second and third in Israel, I think. A string of second and thirds last year. He's the fourth Irishman to win a Giro stage after Shea Elliott, Martin Airlie and Stephen Roach, who won twice in 1987 when he won the Giro. He tweeted very late last night, "It's been a late night for the teams with the ferry transfer to the mainland. I'm going to be wrecked tomorrow, but at least we're all on the same boat." Quite interesting.
Extremely good.
And also he lost Rudy Selig, or Bora lost Rudy Selig, who was ill and couldn't start yesterday's stage. So it was a bit of a freelancer's victory for Bennett
today.
But
very much a team victory, although it wasn't necessarily that apparent in the last 500 metres or so. He wasn't exactly surrounded by teammates, but I was at the Bora Hansgrohe team bus when they all came in, and jubilant scenes, high fives, all sorts of kind of war cries being exchanged or in German. It's a very Austrian team, that team. More than, in terms of the riders and the staff, probably more Austrian than German, in fact.
Well, you spoke to Christian Purmer.
I did. Christian Purmer, the director sportif of Bora Hansgrohe, someone whose connection with Sam Bennett goes back quite a long way. And Lionel, you spoke to someone whose connection with Sam Bennett goes back even further.
Yeah, Nicholas Roach, fellow Irishman, has known Bennett for 10 years. So let's hear the reaction of first Christian Poma and second Nicholas Roach of BMC Racing on Bennett's win.
Well, I first saw Sam Bennett racing in the 2013 Tour of Britain, and I thought we have to sign this guy. And then we signed him, and I did a couple or a whole lot of races with him. And it's very emotional when you achieve the first Grand Tour victory in a bunch sprint with a sprinter you worked for so long.
I know that Sam's someone who can get a bit down when he's not winning. I mean, over the last few days, has it been kind of your job and the other director's job to kind of keep his morale up?
I think this is the job of every sports director who works with a world-class sprinter. They are like the singers in the opera. When they perform, they're happy. When they not perform, they're not so happy. And this is what we are here for.
I'm really, really thrilled. I think, when I saw him, we were in the same hotel in Jerusalem, and I told him that this year it was the best year for him to nail it. Last year he was against an extremely strong Gaviria, and he had a lot of runs for second place. And you know, obviously we've seen that Viviani was in top shape the first day, but I knew that Sam this year was his year, and we had a good talk about it the other day. And it's just I'm really, really thrilled to see him cross the line first. And you know, when I saw him on the way back, he had the tears in his eye, and it was you know, I know Sam probably more than 10 years now, and it's amazing to see him get a stage win in Giro.
So an impressive win for Sam Bennett there, Daniel. I didn't get around to mention that more or less nothing has changed overall. Obviously, Simon Yates's deal in the pink jersey successfully defended that. That was never in question. All the other jerseys stay on the same shoulders too. That means that Esteban Chavez is still in the King of the Mountains lead. Elia Viviani, despite finishing only second on the stage, is still in the points competition lead. And it is Richard Carapaz of Movistar who is leading the best young rider competition.
Well, it was very impressive by Sam Bennett, but there were a couple of close shaves as they came in to the last few kilometres, weren't there?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, it's good you mentioned close shaves, Daniel, because this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Harry's. I have to be transparent here. I don't use a razor. I have a kind of general 2-day scruff permanently. Is that, you know?
No, yeah. One side of your head. Yeah.
Oh yeah. The other side is almost egg-like. As is Chiro's got a bit more going on than me. But anyway, so I can't talk from personal experience about the use of a Harry's razor, but I can talk about admiring their business model, because for decades the cost of razors has been going up, and the two people who founded the company, Jeff and Andy, just two guys who were fed up of paying the increasing prices just to keep a smart, smooth face, they decided they could do something about it. And by taking less profit for themselves and selling directly to the customers over the internet, they can offer Harry's razors at a fraction of the price. You can get a trial set of Harry's razors today, thanks to listening to the Cycling Podcast, by going to harrys.com/cycling, and you'll get for £3.95 a razor handle, a 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover. So go to harrys.com/cycling, and it's £3.95 for your trial set. Now, Daniel, we've been joined
We Hi.
Have the one and only.
Ciro, you were just explaining to me that your fellow Napolitani often come to this region on holiday.
Yes, on holiday, because as you know, Daniel, as you know, Lionel, I'm not focused not at all on the Giro. You already know this. And more, you know, now my life is completely divided in two kind of days. Days with a presence, an appearance in the Cycling Podcast, and days with not an appearance in Cycling Podcast. And this is one of the days with an appearance, so this is one of my best days.
Wow. Ciro, we're going to get straight down to business tonight because we've not got much time. I know you spoke to Giuseppe Martinelli of Astana, the director sportif of Astana. We've been promising that we would give the lowdown on Astana in the last few days. We've not had that much information coming out of the Astana camp. I spoke to Martinelli as well this morning. He told me he was slightly puzzled. He was slightly surprised by some teams' tactics on the stage to Etna, that a lot of teams had a good climber in the front group with Chavez, but they had their leader in the peloton. Yet they were still contributing to the pacemaking at the front of the race, and he didn't understand that. Of course, Astana were the only team that didn't have a rider in the break, the only major sort of team with a leader who didn't also have someone in the break.
Yes, it has been interesting, this way of thinking, because yesterday it was a little bit criticized by the public, by the commentators, because Astana didn't put Mans in the breakaway, and then at the end it was not able to close the gap with the breakaway, and so they didn't win the stage with Lopez. So it was criticized. But this morning, also to me, he said that he didn't understand very well the tactic of some team, especially I think he was referring to UAE Emirates, that they had the team of Fabio Aru had three men in the breakaway yesterday, and in his opinion, this presence of this man that they contribute to this breakaway, in his opinion, has been an advantage for Esteban Chavez that can be a contender for the pink jersey. So for this reason, he said that he didn't understand their tactic.
Ciro, what do you make of Aru so far? Because I'm going to tell you one thing we've noticed over the last few days. We've been in hotels and speaking to the owners of hotels, and they haven't been big cycling fans, but they obviously know the Giro. And they always ask me, is there an Italian this year who could win the Giro? And I say, Aru. And they don't even know who he is. They've never heard of him.
I mean, well, it's also true that in the last 2 years, Aru didn't compete in the Giro, but certainly last year he did a tour of a high level, because he won a stage, he took the jersey for 2 days, and he arrived fifth in Paris. I think this is something, it's true also that he is, during the year, he has not a big exposition to the media, Fabio, because also for his character, you know, we are used maybe with some other kind of riders in the past, as Cipollini, also Pantani, they have more personality.
Even your shadow, Nibali.
Yes, better so far about this aspect of Fabio. So maybe also for this reason, and also for a reason that, you know, maybe cycling was more popular in the past than nowadays in Italy. We must confess this, it's not a shame. I mean, it's like that. Dear Daniel, you know that other things are more important than cycling. In this case, I agree with the Italian public.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. It's that time of the week where we have released the names of the riders who have been nominated for the inaugural Pedaleur de Charme competition of this Giro d'Italia. The winner gets a Rafa manufactured, made, designed Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. Very nice it is too. And we've sorted through the nominations and we've had a look, and the four riders to choose from on Twitter, the poll is on Twitter now, so everyone get voting between now and about this time tomorrow. A bit earlier than this tomorrow. You've got till about an hour before the stage finishes to register your vote. There are two Mitchelton Scott riders on the list. Jack Haig for pedalling charmingly in the breakaway yesterday. Svein Tuft for he's a man of the earth, isn't he, Daniel?
Man of the natural world. Well, you know what we're going to do? Something. We're going to do a big knockout interview with Svein Tuft before the end of the Giro, because this could be his last Grand Tour, and I don't want to miss the opportunity.
I hope so. He's 41 years old, isn't he?
Correct. And he just had a baby, I think, in the last year or so, and he's off into the wilds. And he's just going to disappear. At the end of the Giro, he's just going to disappear into the into the sunset.
Well, let's hope. Well, not let's hope. We don't want to influence the vote here, but maybe he will be heading off into the wild with a t-shirt. Anyway, so the four nominations are two Mitchelton Scott riders, Jack Haig and Svein Tuft. Max Schachmann, for looking so good in that white jersey with the quick step shorts and just pedalling charmingly. And Antonio Nibali.
Now, the little fish, il pesciolino.
Yeah, well, I think this has been heavily influenced by our latest episode of Kilometre Zero, which is available for friends of the podcast. Antonio Nibali, of course, the younger brother, the less illustrious brother of the two. Vincenzo Nibali, of course, multiple Grand Tour champion, not riding here, but Antonio is riding as a domestique for Bahrain Merida. He's been nominated by several people too. I think people maybe just got a sense of his character from his interview in Kilometre Zero.
For those who haven't heard the Kilometre Zero, Ciro puts in a fantastic cameo in that. He tells us about the wolf. The wolf, of course, being Vincenzo Nibali's father. This is, you know, we're deep into the labyrinthine territory now of kind of jokes or references that only people who have listened to the podcast for a couple of years will understand. But Vincenzo Nibali's father, also obviously Antonio's father, is more concerned about Antonio's career than he is Vincenzo's. That's what Ciro revealed in our Kilometre Zero. But
well, you can listen to that by becoming a friend of the podcast, thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. Sign up there. There's loads of content on there, £15 for the year. But Daniel, as we... It's not that it's been a mundane day on the Giro today, because Sam Bennett's stage win was notable and impressive, but we're still digesting, aren't we, what happened on Mount Etna yesterday. And a couple of the things that we missed were that Louis Menkes had a pretty disappointing day on Mount Etna, lost 3.5 minutes. Richard Moore sent a message this morning. You may remember Richard Moore from the cycling podcast. He sent a message to us saying that he spoke to Doug Ryder, the boss of Dimension Data, when we were back in Israel. And Doug Ryder apparently said that Menkes had lost too much weight over the winter, and you know, maybe that's affected his form a little bit. Who knows? But he was outperformed by his younger Australian teammate Ben O'Connor. And Daniel, you spoke to Ben O'Connor this morning.
Before that, Lionel, I've just realised that the bar we're sitting in is playing Jamiroquai. Of course, Ciro missed one of our... Did he miss one of our live events
because he
was going to a Jamiroquai concert?
He was in London.
This
on
was
the
2017, not 1998.
No, that's peak Ciro, isn't it? That
yeah,
is peak
is.
Ciro.
Anyway, Ben Connor from Western Australia, performed extremely well on Etna yesterday. His currently lying on general classification. I'll just find him. He's 12th on general classification. Has surprised quite a number of people already and may just continue to surprise people over the rest of the Giro.
Your first experience of a big mountain stage, and I guess we could call it that, in Giro d'Italia. I mean, just tell me about the climb up Etna and what you were thinking.
It was extremely long. I mean, the first part was quite draggy up until Regalana. And then it certainly climbed before it was actually categorised. But Stana set a good tempo, and for me it was okay because it wasn't too surgy, and I prefer the long, hard climbs. The longer kind of mountain stages, it tends to suit my kind of characteristic. When we turned right onto the small road, I started to kind of suffer there. I didn't feel too bad, but I just couldn't accelerate. But it was really just a point of staying in that group for as long as you can. And as you said, it's the first Grand Tour mountain stage I've ever done. So it was really just a point of just being there as long as you could until really you blew.
And the result itself, is that kind of ballpark where you would have hoped or expected to be?
It's where you kind of dream to be. You never really know. Like, you always, especially because once again, it's the first Grand Tour, first Giro, so you still doubt yourself. You're still like, oh, I know I had a good tour of Alps, but here there's 18 World Tour teams, not 8 or 10 or however many there were. So to be able to do it there on Etna was, yeah, that's another massive, massive boost. And I'll just keep trying to be in the front group as long as I can. I don't know how I'm going to cope in the third week, even later in the second, but I'll just try until I blow.
And you said, well, obviously you've not done this race before. You didn't really know what to expect. Guys in the team, experienced guys who have done this race before, the staff, what have they been telling you about what you can aspire to in this race?
It's not so much what you need to aspire to. It's more about just trying to give it all. I mean, the team was confident. They knew I had the shape. They knew from the races I'd be able to perform well. But there's no pressure to be, okay, you have to be in the top 10. You have to be in the top 5. That's not part of it. It's more of the fact of trying to be there for as long as you can. And obviously we had that little aim, maybe to try and take the white jersey. I mean, it'd be an absolute dream to be on a Giro podium, even for just if it's for a day or two. So we can try that, and yeah.
And just finally, I know you're thinking about where you're going to be in 2 days, but really easy question: where do you see yourself in 2 years?
I'd like to try and see if you could be in the top 5, but that's just throwing things. For now, I'm just going to keep enjoying racing and being in the mountains with the best and having fun.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. As ever, the discount code, if you want to order some Science in Sport products, the discount code for all Cycling Podcast listeners is SISCP25. Go to scienceinsport.com, order your stuff. SISCP25 is a discount code, and you'll get 25% off your entire order. And tomorrow on the podcast, we've been asking listeners to send in their questions about nutrition. Riders who ride sportives or, you know, Audax events or race, how can they help fuel their ride better? And we've put those questions to some of Science in Sport staff, and we will have a question and answer in tomorrow night's episode. But Daniel, this morning we were in a town called Pizzo, P-I-Z-Z-O.
We were.
And there's almost a Venn diagram of references here because, well, Pizzo itself, the name, Reggio Calabria and Steve Morabito are all quite significantly linked
down the rabbit hole.
I mean...
yes, we are. Right, let's start from the beginning. Pizzo. So Pizzo is... The word that's used in Italy for the protection money paid by the paid to the mafia, in order for the mafia to protect businesses. So, in parts of Sicily in particular, but even in Calabria where we are today, and in fact, the mafia is probably stronger in Calabria now than it is in Sicily, but it's got a different name, the 'Ndrangheta. Well over 50% of businesses still pay the pizzo, reportedly.
What does that actually mean? Is that to protect their businesses from being like physically attacked?
Well, if they don't pay it, then they are subject to whatever kind of malevolent activities the mafia might decide to, you know, exert upon their business.
Crikey. And Reggio Calabria is the home of not the Sicilian mafia, but is it an offshoot?
Well, no, it's a completely different mafia called the 'Ndrangheta, which, as I said, is more feared now, more powerful than Cosa Nostra, which is the Sicilian mafia. Today, Lionel, on the way to the start, we went past the port of Gioia Tauro, through which reportedly 80% of the cocaine consumed in Europe passes, all controlled by the 'Ndrangheta. We went past Rosarno, which is probably the archetypal 'Ndrangheta-controlled town. And coincidentally enough, just at that point, we drove alongside some Groupama FDJ team cars, and they went off the road. And they went off the road towards Rosarno. Why is this relevant? This is relevant because Steve Morabito is a Swiss climber, a Swiss domestique who rides for Groupama FDJ.
Now, you said to me, I wonder what Steve Morabito thinks about having the same surname as an incredibly feared mafia family.
I'd never heard or read any reference to the 'Ndrangheta in connection with Steve Morabito. However, after the finish today, I would have liked to speak to Steve Morabito about this at the start, but I didn't get around to speaking to him. At the finish this evening, I contacted someone, a friend in the Groupama FDJ team, and asked them to ask Steve Morabito if he did indeed have any connection to the Morabito clan, the Morabito 'Ndrina,
which in the, well, up until sort of about 10 years ago, was about the most fearsome family in Italy. What did I discover? Steve Morabito is apparently related to the Morabito 'Ndrina or clan. Wow. And his grandparents, so I'm told the connection is dates back two or three generations. However, it was either his grandparents or his great-grandparents decided to leave Calabria precisely because things were getting a little bit spicy in the clan. And they went to live in Switzerland. And they don't particularly like to speak about it now. However, it's very much part of their family history.
I wonder if Steve Morabito and Antonio Nibali get in a break together, whether Morabito will warn Nibali that he may end up the day sleeping with the little fishies.
Oh.
Hey? Hey? Well, listen, there's a band about to set up here outside this bar, and as much as we might play out on a little bit of this music if they set up in time, who knows? But we probably should call it a day, more or less. Now, a couple of days ago, I had a conversation with Dave Brailsford, Team Sky's principal, about the ongoing salbutamol case concerning Chris Froome.
We almost got a drum roll there.
Having a drum roll for this story, almost, it does feel slightly inappropriate, but we're not making light of this as a serious story. But we played part of that a couple of nights ago, and then yesterday's stage was too dramatic to squeeze in anymore. So we'll conclude that this evening. I continued my conversation with Dave Brailsford, asking about a story that had been written by our colleague Matt Dickinson of The Times about a research paper published by the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology, which is basically claiming that WADA's test for salbutamol is unreliable and needs to be overhauled. Now, shouldn't really use claiming where science is involved, but you get the gist. Anyway, I started by asking Brailsford whether he'd read that story and what his thoughts on it were.
Yeah, I did read it. I mean, that's obviously out in the public domain. It was independent of... It's totally independent of anything to do with us, obviously, and it made for interesting reading, you know, and I think all of that, there's you know, quite a lot of literature, and the scientific community have obviously got a view, and like all scientific communities, the differing views and debate and challenge, but yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting read. And just goes to show, I think, that there are certain parts of the scientific community who may see things in one way, and others who see it in a different way. And all that we ask is that whatever framework or rules that are in place to do two things really, is which is to protect clean athletes and catch those who want to cheat. But we want to make sure that those rules are as robust as possible. And we know over time the rules, the WADA rules, the WADA regs and everything, they do get changed. They do, you know, move forward as science discovers more and more. It's complex. And I wish I'd be able to sit down and explain why it's so complex, etc. But it is complex. And on the one hand, we want this resolved, and the, you know, the shadow or the cloud that may have been, you know, cast over Chris, the team, the, you know, the sport, really to be removed as quickly as possible. So we're as motivated as, you know, I saw a couple of people who said that, you know, we were trying to delay the process somehow. It's just absolute nonsense. We want the truth. We want the truth, and I think that's what we should be working towards. It's like, let's establish the truth and the best way of doing it. But if that means we've got to go and get it done accurately, and it's going to take a bit of time to get there, then so be it. And you know, and not desirable for anybody. But if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes.
And I concluded my conversation with Brailsford, asking him whether he was frustrated that the case was being played out in public, because let's not forget that there will have been riders who have registered an adverse analytical finding for salbutamol and possibly other drugs that aren't outright banned but are subject to threshold, as salbutamol is, but this case has been played out in public because of a leak. I wondered whether he knew where that leak had come from, and I also asked him about the comments by UCI president David Lapartion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if we're going to have, you know, if you're going to have situations where rules and there are processes which are created, which rightly so are there for good reason, but you've also got, you know, the confidentiality around it. Then if that confidentiality is broken, then that changes the dynamic and the context massively, I think. And that's what happens. That's what's happened in this case. And I think that's it's a real shame. It's massively disappointing. Massively disappointing that whoever decided to leak that information did so, and they should have a long, sharp, hard look at themselves in the mirror, I think, and really question their own integrity as to why they would do that. And back to your point about the UCI and Le Par chant and all the rest of it. For me, you shouldn't be commenting in public about it. He's a presence of the whole sport. He's a presence of the UCI. He's new to the job and he's come in with enthusiasm and all the rest of it. But I can understand that, you know, the pressures he might be under. But equally, I think he's responsible more than anybody else that every athlete in the sport, you know, who are operating under the World Tour rules and WADA rules that he's governing, actually can feel that they will be fairly protected in any sense or any situation that may arise. And he has to be that the guy at the top going, right, there's a fair process, people are entitled to a fair hearing. And as soon as he comments, whether he realises it or not, he's influencing the process, either for the one way or the other. It doesn't really matter, he shouldn't influence it at all. And so I think that's a lesson for him to learn pretty quick, I'd say.
Well, Daniel, I think we can safely say that we haven't cleared anything up with regard to Chris Froome's salbutamol case. We wait and see what happens. We'll see how he climbs over the next 2 days in the sort of medium mountains, Monte Vergine tomorrow and Gran Sasso d'Italia on Sunday, and then the rest day. Two pretty long stages, aren't they? Both in excess of 200 kilometres on difficult roads. Not real mountain stages, but tough enough.
Who wins tomorrow, Lionel? Because Monte Vergine is a climb that's been used several times in the Giro, and it's not a difficult climb by any means. And the type of rider who has generally won there has been someone who can climb, but someone who's also a very fast finisher. We've made a lot already this week about the lack of the dearth of that kind of rider in the Giro. So previous winners include Danilo Di Luca and Damiano Cunego. Last time, in 2000, and I think it was 2011, Bart de Klerk of Lotto won up there. It was indeed 2011, but we were speaking to a couple of people this morning who pointed out that Simon Yates is by far the fastest of the general classification contenders, and tomorrow is a perfect opportunity for him to claim more seconds in a time bonus. I don't think he'll necessarily be able to drop people tomorrow, but he could well win a sprint.
Let's clarify what you mean by the fastest, because, you know, obviously they ride flipping fast up the mountains, but what you mean there is that he has that little bit of extra acceleration, that little bit of extra zip and
people
sprint.
People understand that, don't they? The fastest.
We might have picked up lots
is that
of
an
new
Italianism?
Listeners here.
It's a...
Yeah, so you're saying that he can climb quickly, but also has that...
Well, he's a fast finisher.
He's a fast finisher. And who else is in the same bracket as Yates in this Giro?
No one. I mean, Rod Illingworth, the Team Sky race coach, suggested to us this morning that Thibaut Pinot is probably the next fastest of the general classification contenders. I think the finish tomorrow is not dissimilar to the last couple of kilometres of the Europa climb last year, where Dumoulin won and dropped everyone. So I think he will go well. I mean, it's the kind of climb where you'll be able to use the big ring most of the way up.
Right.
So
what will be interesting, I think, is whether Mitchelton Scott try to continue to gain time or whether they sort of hold what they've got for the moment. I don't think it would be smart to hold what they've got at the moment. I think they need to gamble and try to win the race while they can now and hold on at the end, because Simon Yates and Esteban Chavez would both be a little bit vulnerable in the final week, maybe. But we shall see. We will be back tomorrow evening, won't we? This has been a luxurious 7:30 finish for us. We can
hotel. How far away is our hotel? 12 kilometres.
20 minutes away.
We're on Easy Street, aren't we?
We'll be having dinner by 8:30. Best day of the Giro so far. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
mangiano le femmine.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Ci gira nella tenevo giardina